Welcome once again, kids and caballeros and all those other people at the ships at sea and things and stuff and stuff and all that may encompass the entirety of existence. We have a special guest today. Goes by the name of Jason Shannon. He's an author. He's written a couple of books. I think more than a couple. Actually, it looks like about a few. Welcome to the show, Jason. How is it going?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Okay, you went quiet.
Can you hear me now?
Let me post some more additions to my thing so that I have a louder. Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, weird nothing thing. Sometimes like sometimes the programs do weird things when they're doing one thing, and then when you combine it with another thing, it's like, hey, I've changed the setting. What? Ah.
Yeah, it's Skynet is after us. It's just trying to mess with us right now.
Skynet is always after us.
Yes.
It's got a bit of a thing.
So anyway, yes, I'm doing well, so thank you for having me.
Well, you're most welcome. I'm glad to have you on here. I like to have guests. We can talk about stuff. Did you know that potato can be pronounced potato or potato?
I have known that for many, many years.
Excellent. So, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, as you were saying, I've got a few books. The number officially is 4 right now. I mostly write science fiction, although one series I've been working on has been described as fantasy-esque. I like to consider it post-apocalyptic science fiction, but it does have kind of fantasy elements. There's some sword and sandal stuff going on in there. I started publishing. My first book came out in 2013. That would be The Zimmer Insurgency. And I've been writing diligently ever since, trying to get as much out there as I can.
So, do you ascribe to the pantser plotting kind of methodology?
That's run through that for me quickly.
Pantsing is doing it by the seat of your pants. Plotting is like plotting the entire thing. I was like, oh, in chapter 2, they're going to do this. And when they get over here, they're going to do that. And it's like, oh, everybody's going to be like, then there's going to be a party, and then the end.
A little bit of both. So I have like a general view of where each chapter might go, and I generally have the ending in mind, so I don't, you know, waste 200 pages and then get a brick wall at the end. But then sometimes I'll start writing a chapter and thinking I'm going to go one way with it, and just, you know, the stream of writing takes me, and all of a sudden I've gone in a completely different direction than what I intended to.
Yes, those darn characters like to tell us, screw you, man, I'm going over here, not over there.
Yes, exactly. In fact, my second book, The Hounds of Harrigan, I often remark this, it's about 1,200 pages, and I in no way intended it for it to be that long when I began writing it.
Well, that is understandable because, yeah, I've seen that happen many times. It's just a weird little, hey, you know what? What if... well, let's keep going kind of thing.
Yeah, well, for me, it was I kept adding characters, and the chapters are written kind of third-person fixed perspective. So each chapter follows one individual character, and then I kept saying, like, oh, that character have a chapter. And then once I give them a chapter, you know, I have to give them more than one chapter to kind of continue their story. And all of a sudden, I'm like, I'm nowhere near where I thought it would be at this point, and I've got 100,000 words, and it just kept going from there.
Now, do you edit your own work, or do you get an editor to do the editing?
Both. So I will do several edits myself. I'll edit as I go. So sometimes I will, you know, reread the last chapter or two to kind of re-motivate myself and just do a little edit as I go there. Once I get to the end of the first draft, then I'll do a full edit myself. And then I pass it off to my editor. And once she's done with it, then I will do my own final edit again, and then I'll use her notes as well to make the final product.
So following in the footsteps of edit.
Yes, it really does help. In fact, the difference between the first draft and the final product is astounding. I'll do my first edit sometimes, and I'll just be shocked at like how rough it feels.
Now, do you ever try going back to something you might have written like 10, 15 years ago? It's like, whoa, what the hell did I do? Why did I write that?
Well, two things there. So my most recent book, Brain's Agenda, actually was written 10 years ago. That makes me feel old. And because it was short and I kind of, held on to the ideas in there, I went through this year and did a little edit on it. I updated a lot of the smaller details and did a thorough edit there. So that was salvageable. The second thing is my first novel, The Zimmer Insurgency, I actually haven't read since it came out because I am only remembering the few things in there that I would want to change and I'm kind of not too happy with. So I'm afraid that I'm going to read it and just be like the whole book will be like that and be like, oh my God, I can't believe I wrote it like this. So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, wait till you get much older and it's even worse. Just the word warning.
I can only imagine, yeah.
Word warning. Us old guys, it's like, wait a sec. I wrote that when I was what? What the hell? But I'm also a big fan of nothing is wasted, because even if it's crappily written, rewriting it can still make it spiffy.
Well, it's also that, you know, if you pick up almost any author and read their first novel, they all kind of read the same, where it comes off brash and not well thought out, and they sometimes are trying to say way too much. And those are not, you know, wasted reads. You can still get a nice perspective into what the author was thinking at the time. So even if it's not the best novel, it still is not a waste.
Exactly. I mean, some people might call me a hoarder. I call myself a collector, but I acquire many things and keep reusing it whenever I can.
Exactly.
Now, Mark in the chat room has been talking comics for a little bit. It's like, do you read any comic books?
I do. I don't read a tremendous amount, but I do read some.
Such as?
So I tend to stay away from like the Marvel DC, just because they're kind of almost intimidating to get into. They seem like there's a lot of backstory and a lot of like, you need to read this issue to understand this and that and the other. Some of the stuff I read, I've read Brian K. Vaughan, Why the Last Man.
Excellent series. So,
it is, actually, yes. Are they still... I know that the movie or the TV show was in development hell for a while. Is that still going on?
Still in development hell.
Okay. I've also been reading Saga, which I think I'm all caught up on there. And I read them by the graphic novel, not by the actual individual issue. And then... Sex Criminals with Matt Fraction is another one that I really enjoy.
Which is an awesome story idea. It's like, what? So you have sex, time stops. Oh, okay, yeah. Commit crimes. Awesome.
I also love it. If you read that series, there's all sorts of small little minor jokes that are just kind of hidden in the artwork, and it's just hilarious to read.
Yes, it is. But Saga is a great series. They're kind of on hiatus right now. They haven't officially said that it's stopped. But they're like, haven't released anything new in like, I think about 6 months now.
Well, the last volume that I read, I won't spoil it, but it ended with a fairly significant cliffhanger. And it kind of left me wondering like, okay, where are they going to go from here? Because that whole volume, and I think the one before it, they were kind of just dragging their feet a little bit, not really much advancing the story a whole lot. And then all of a sudden it just did a complete 180.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm not sure where it's going from there.
And then there's two issues of the comics that came out after where that point is, and we're still waiting for what happens afterwards.
Oh, so they're like following minor characters or something at that point?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I think the major character that you're talking about is like, okay, something else is going to happen now, so we'll see. I'm excited. I want to see it happen, but I don't know if they're going to tank the storyline or not.
Well, I remember reading somewhere that Brian K. Vaughan, he had Why the Last Man planned out pretty much, plotting it, as you said earlier, right to the end. But Saga is more of a just going with the flow until the readership declines, and then he'll cancel it.
Yeah, so, they kind of started out with, here's the first issue. Great. It's controversial. Awesome. Wait, people liked it? Okay, let's do another one. And then kept going.
Yeah. The one thing I didn't really like about that series is that it seems like the pacing is not great. Like, I know that the girl is growing up and she's, like, I don't know, 10 or 12 now. And it just seems like not that much time has passed. So I'm not sure if the pacing worked out 100% there.
Well, You could always read Spider-Man, who's been basically a teenager for the last 32 years.
That's true. I've always liked the fact that this is not so much comics, but in The Simpsons, Lisa.
Also, yeah, Lisa.
Exactly. Lisa was born during the 1984 Olympics, and she's still only 8 years old.
Even though they've been 27 years in development as an animation.
Yes.
Or more.
It might be up to 30 by now.
It could be. I know it's one of the. I know it's the longest. I'm not going to say I know it is, but I'm fairly certain it's the longest running Western animation series. And I know it's in the top category for longest running series, period.
I think there's some like daytime soap operas that are still way ahead of it.
Right.
But they do like 5 episodes a week.
Well, yeah. So. And they suck.
Yeah, I don't watch those.
No. But my mom does. So it's like, ugh. I don't like coming to their place to watch these shows. But that's okay. She doesn't watch them when I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
Which is funny. So, back to the science fiction. Would you consider yourself hardcore science fiction, medium science fiction, or light on the science fiction?
Probably somewhere in the light to medium range. I tend to... sometimes I'll do something that's a little bit further into the future than I might have planned out thoroughly. And then as I write it or as I'm editing it, I have to get into the weeds of like, okay, how is our world going to get to this point? What technology are they going to have just in terms of their day-to-day life, right? Are they going to have massive advancements in their cell phones that we can't anticipate? Or, you know, what is the economy going to be doing at that point? If I'm dealing with something 100, 200 years in the future, are people still going to be driving cabs? Is that all going to be automated? How is that going to look? Do I have to deal with all these questions? So sometimes I'll just dial it back a little bit and focus on kind of the near to medium range.
So do you try and get into the deep details, or do you just try and say, only if it's story related, otherwise I'm not going to worry about it?
Well, sometimes I'll throw it in there as a just a kind of like a one-off or like a little background detail. But my writing is very non-expositional to begin with, so I don't like to introduce an element and then spend 2 pages explaining what that element is. I'll just kind of throw it in there and then maybe through 1 or 2 more references later on so that, you know, a close reader can figure it out. But if it's not really important to the story, then I'm not going to waste pages on it.
So not Stephen King style?
I've not read very much Stephen King, so I can't really comment there.
Okay, well, he'll spend like 5 pages describing the wallpaper.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. If you're into that thing, which in some things I am, in some things I'm not.
I've heard that Robert Jordan with The Wheel of Time does that as well. That's another series I haven't read just because it's so daunting, but I've heard that it's good, except that he is a grass describer.
Well, okay, if we're going to go to Jordan, the first 3 books in his Wheel of Time trilogy are really good. They're done as separate books, they work as separate books, and it's a fairly good story, and it's got a good grounding for a fantasy world. It's not too crazy on the, hey, let's spend 5 or 10 pages explaining the sharpness of a sword and then move on to the dragons, but it is fairly consistent and well done. Once you get outside of those 3 books, each book is not so much a story on its own, it's a chapter of the larger story.
Right.
And as you progress, the books get even worse and worse and worse that way, whereas the last book I read was, I don't know, I think it was number 9 or whatever. I was like, wait a second, there's only a few more pages left to this book. They're in the middle of this whole thing. How the hell are they going to wrap this up? Oh my god, they didn't wrap it up. He actually has it as a to be continued.
So it's similar to George R.R. Martin then.
Yeah. Except his early stuff. His early stuff didn't do that.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking of the Game of Thrones series, and for the first maybe 2 books in that series, it was, or maybe it was 3, they tended to be self-contained, and you knew the story was going to continue, but it did have an actual ending.
Yeah.
But later in the series, it just tends to be like, okay, I run out of pages here, so I'm just going to cut it here, and you know, you have to wait 6 or 8 more years for the next book.
Yeah. And in the old days, that's how books were done. Nowadays, it's like instant gratifications. I need the next chapter now. Okay, let me just write that out. Sure.
Yeah, so I'm still waiting for the next book in there.
But I think you have a bit of a wait because the next 2 series will be out, I think, before his next book is.
Yeah.
But whatever. He's enjoying his stuff. He's been doing it long enough. He should enjoy whatever he needs to enjoy on that.
Yeah, he should. He's definitely not to be pushed.
Totally.
Should take his time and do it right.
Yeah. So, what would you say some of your sources of inspiration for are on your writing? I mean, are there any particular writers you're a big fan of?
Well, I guess Alan Steele, the science fiction author. He, I didn't read a whole lot throughout high school, but he was one author I stuck with, and I've actually got his whole Coyote series in hardcover, like first edition hardcover.
Nice.
So he's really good. I like him. I still follow his stuff. In recent years, I've kind of branched out more away from sci-fi, and just in terms of my reading. Actually, most of my reading these days is like nonfiction, because I'm doing a lot of research for my books. But in terms of, yeah, that becomes a real pain. But in terms of like just other authors, their style I like. Greg Iles is a mystery thriller author. I really like his style of how he plots things out. Charles Bukowski, actually, I began reading this year, and I really like his kind of simple prose that really is excellent on the pacing and gets the story right. There's a few others, but yeah, I kind of have a wide variety.
Well, and that's good, because I mean, from what I like, what I'm used to doing as well, I've read all kinds of shit. Yeah, I mean, it gives you better grounding on how to look at stuff, I think. I mean,
yeah, you don't want to get stuck down a rabbit hole of, you know, just reading one genre or just reading one subgenre, and you're kind of missing the wider world of writing.
Precisely, because I mean, I think the best way that people who are reading and identify with a story, identify and read with a story is like, hey, I can imagine that being real.
Exactly, yeah.
But what I was actually giggling about earlier is like, research. That's actually one of my questions. I have little notes here that I just put little quick notes here, because I my whole show in general is usually a, what the hell, let's do this and then do that. It's like, la, 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 la. So I only put like little crib notes on here. But speaking of research, what kind of research do you do? I mean, I was reading some of your Rain's, the book.
Rain's Agenda?
That one. Just now, or earlier. And it's like, there's a lot of stuff about Chinese culture, Indian culture here, all sorts of other stuff. It's like, there's a lot of things here.
Yeah, so, well, my most research, I guess, would deal with my Mongolian series, The Hounds of Harijin. And for that, I've got, like, a shelf full of basically textbooks that I'm sure were only, you know, bought by maybe 200 or 300 people worldwide. And I've got one of those copies because they're thoroughly footnoted and not that enjoyable to read. But, yeah, I've got all that stuff, and I have to trudge through it. In terms of the Chinese culture stuff, I just have an interest in these cultures, Mongolia, China, Korea. Now I'm getting big into, and you pick up little things along the way. I have other books there that I can read. In terms of actually, kind of for my first novel, it really the only research I did was just kind of Google Maps distances between two points and trying to figure out the, you know, the time distance. If I'm moving at this speed, how long would it take to get there? But in recent years, yeah, I've been kind of going out and getting a lot more like academic works or even periodicals and stuff like that.
What about Google News?
I try to stay away from like you know, stories that break that. Because especially in today's culture, you know, it's all headline news, and then a week later it's forgotten because there's some other headline news. And if you start basing stories over, you know, news stories that are kind of lost or forgotten, then all of a sudden it's lost its relevance. So I want to make my writing a little bit more timeless than, you know, just on the ball immediately. This was a story last week. I want to write a book about it.
Okay, so in that vein, Rain's Agenda, how long ago did you write that?
10 years.
So the interesting bit I've started reading when I was starting to read it, Amazon forest fires, the whole thing is like, that's actually becoming
relevant again because now,
there's
a
whole thing.
So that actually, I think that story broke like the week I came out with the book. And everyone started commenting on it, like, oh yeah, so it's about this. I'm like, actually, I wrote this 10 years ago. It's just a unhappy coincidence.
Yeah. And it's just getting worse there, too. It's like the whole political structure and everything. It's like, really? Can't you people see that this is a bad path to go down? I mean, you could probably do some tooling on it, but serious?
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
It's not good down there right now.
No, it's not a very... And the fact that he... Oh, I was reading earlier, hearing earlier about him basically insulting Greta with calling her a brat. And it's like, really?
Oh, really?
He's like
16. I haven't heard that.
What the hell? Yeah.
Yeah.
Insane world we live in, right?
Yeah, it gets crazier every day.
Yep. So
we do have a reality TV show host as leader of the free world right now. So I believe there was a lot of 1980s sci-fi that kind of predicted that in the dystopian vein.
1948 is the published date of 1984.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, he specifically chose 1984 to be the title and the thing based on, I'm writing this in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that, okay, by the way, have you ever seen the movie Idiocracy?
Yes.
Throwing in tangents. That book, 1984, the other British one that I always forget the name of, Brave New World, Aldous Huxley.
Brave New World, yep.
And Idiocracy. These are not supposed to be manuals or guidelines as how to go. They're supposed to show you what not to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, 1984 and Brave New World were both their own kind of critiques of the Soviet Union, which already existed at the time.
Correct. But they're very applicable to what's going on in the U.S. right now.
Yes.
So it's like, yeah. We won't talk about politics in this show. Well, we will.
Let's get back to the writing.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, oh, geez, you've already answered a couple of my script notes. Damn it. I can't get into that. So what got you into writing in general?
What did get me into writing? Actually, here, I remember I grew up in Belleville, which is a little town down towards Kingston. And I remember I was probably ninth grade, and I went out with my father and my brother to the local bookstore, which I think is closed down now. Not specifically for myself, my brother was getting a book, but I just checked out like the science fiction section there at the time, because that was the only genre I was interested in at the time. And this is a local bookstore, so the sci-fi section was like, you know, 4 feet wide, like one shelf. And I remember finding one book that kind of, I could tell by the way I read the back cover that, you know, the first two paragraphs on the back were the first 150 or so pages of the book. And there wasn't going to be much enjoyment just catching up to that point. So I just kind of remarked to myself, like, oh, I could write a better book than this. And that's kind of how it began.
Yeah, I'm quite happy that I live in Toronto, where we had the world's biggest bookstore.
Actually, that's closed down now.
It's closed down now, yes.
I know that because I work in construction as my day job, and we are building a building on that exact piece of property.
Oh, no. Yeah. I love that building. That building was crazy.
It was. And actually, there's a used bookstore right next door.
Mm-hmm.
I think BMV it's called.
Yep.
And I went in there trying to set up, see if they did anything for local authors. And, of course, they're a used bookstore. So they're like, not really. You know, you wouldn't be able to sell a lot here at regular price. And as I walked out, I thought, oh, you know what? I should check the world's biggest bookstore. Just Google that, because it was around here somewhere. And as I was walking back into my site, it brought it up at the exact address I was walking into. And I'm like, oh, I guess that's what was here beforehand.
So think of a bookstore the size of a freaking warehouse.
I was in there. I've been in there before. I was in there 7 or 8 years ago. But yeah, it was massive.
Their science fiction section was the size of some schools' libraries.
Oh, nice.
I would generally... So I used to read a crap ton, and I mean a crap ton. I would go through a book like a couple of days, done. And I still enjoy it. I can't read books that I've read before, because if I do, I lose it, because I already recognize everything that's going to unfold. But I would go in there.
I can read stuff just quickly. We'll reread stuff that's really good, yep. But I will let it sit for a few years so I forget some of the minor details. I don't forget the ending or anything. But some of the minor details that you rediscover along the way, they make it worth it.
I unfortunately can't do that. As soon as I start reading 5-10 pages or whatever in, the entire thing is lapped out for me. But yeah, so what I would do occasionally there is I'd walk in and I'd walk out with 20 to 50 books. I was like, okay, as long as I only do this once a month. Because otherwise I was going bankrupt. But fun times, fun times.
I wish I could read that fast, but I don't really have that many hours of the day to sit down and blow through a book in like a day and a half.
Remember, I was still a younger person. Mm-hmm. I had lots of time then. Now, oh crap, trying to read a book. I've got 2 books on the go right now, and I've been trying to read them for the last 3 weeks.
I know, I'm the same way. My to-read shelf is getting too big, and my currently reading shelf is also getting too big.
This is why comics are awesome. You get these short little chapters once a month.
That's true.
Oh, wait. My to-be-read list on the comics is also 1, 2, 3 boxes full. So, it's the same. But in that vein as well, now we're going to go into the dichotomy changing in the evolution of writing in general. That was a pretty open-ended statement. I'll go and be more specific now. Because I'm a little kooky. You may have noticed that when we were at the Artist Alley project there.
Just a little bit.
So, I have noticed being around long enough, you notice these things. There's been a large shift in the way both we write, the way we package, and then the way we actually try to sell our product as writers. I would imagine that you're probably in the newer side of that, having come only in the last 10 years or so. Even though in that period of time, how much of a shift in that do you see?
Just in the past few years, the only thing major, I guess, I've seen is, the success of series like The Hunger Games, and then all the spinoffs from that. And now everything kind of gets marketed as, it reads like this, or it reads like that, and it always gets compared to something that's currently successful, which I don't think was the case too long ago. But in terms of just the overall trends, I know, I'll mention one thing. I was reading Dune, Frank Herbert's Dune. It is a great novel, but the one thing about it is that the perspective constantly changes throughout the scene. So you'll get Paul's thoughts, and then like a paragraph later you'll get Duncan's thoughts, and it's just kind of jumping around. And that I don't think is a thing that happens in a lot of modern writing. It does come off as a lot very disjointed. I think a lot of writers now are doing the more of the George R. R. Martin fixed perspective, and then you start a new chapter to follow someone else, which I actually kind of prefer more, although Dune is still a great novel.
A great series of novels.
That's true, although they begin to get a little bit more off the rails the further you go.
Well, yeah, because that's other authors now writing it, because he passed away.
Yeah.
But still.
Although I've only read one of those prequels by his son, which was not as good.
No, they weren't, but he did try, and he was trying to flesh it out a lot more, like in the same way that J.R.R. Tolkien was doing it with the Lord of the Rings stuff. It's like, hey, I got this fun book. Wait, people want more. Oh, okay, let's write more. There are actually 30 books in The Lord of the Rings.
Really?
Yeah. Most people only know about the first 6, which were combined into 3. But then there was also The Silmarillion, and he's got these whole books that are basically, they read like nonfiction. Explaining the history of the elves and the dwarves and all these other people and all this other stuff over here. A complete history of the last 5,000 years and stuff. It's like, that's an awful lot of reading that I think hardcore fantasy people would read. But, sorry, recovering from the sickness. But the average, normal, regular reader would not.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't go that far into researching it.
But he did build his own entire language.
That's impressive, if perhaps a little, crazy.
Well, he was a linguistics teacher as well, so it's like, okay, it's true. Kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So he did it as part of an experiment. It's like, well, how can I? What if I made a language? What would it sound like? And he showed how it worked. And it's like, this is kind of cool. Now, do you use anything like that in part of your writing structure? I mean, are you trying to consciously develop anything like that as a kind of a spin on the way that the actual stories develop?
Well, I don't go so far as like develop my own language or anything like that. In fact, in my most extensive work, The Hounds of Harrigan, I intentionally did not set it in like a fantasy setting, and I chose a real, it's mostly Australia where it takes place. Mostly because I didn't want like the free open canvas of having to design a map. I want kind of like at least some fixed borders where I can just map things onto. But otherwise, I do the world building, and now that I've got so many pages written on that, it's fun to kind of go and Easter egg other aspects of the world that I've referenced in other books. But that's pretty much the extent of my stuff there. It's just the world building.
Cool. Now, do your books all interconnect, or like loosely, or do they deliberately relate to the same world environment?
Well, so I have two books, The Hounds of Harrigan and then The Moon Panther, which is a series of prequels. It's a prequel novellas in that same universe, and those two obviously connect. The other two are complete standalones, although I do like to break the fourth wall, and which I usually do by like referencing something out of universe as though it's in universe. So it's kind of a, you know, keen readers will read that and be like, wait a minute, that was from another universe. And it's just a bit of a crossover that breaks the fourth wall.
Okay. For like shits and giggles, or with a deliberate purpose?
Just shits and giggles.
Gotcha.
Just, actually, an author that I really like, here's a little story for you. Guy Gavriel Kay, who's he lives in Toronto, I believe.
Yep.
And he writes like historical fantasy, and one of my favorite novels of his is Under Heaven, wherein he's basically starting like a new universe. All his previous books had taken place kind of in the same universe, which had two moons, and that was how you distinguished it. It was always like the characters at some point would look up and there's, oh, the two moons are shining or whatever. And this Under Heaven began a new series where there was only one moon, but there's a poet within that book that writes a poem about the moon, and then he starts talking about, oh, I'd like to write a world where there was two moons. Wouldn't you like that? Is the person he's talking to. And the person goes like, oh, yeah, I would really like that. That would be awesome. It's just kind of a nice little wink and a nod to the audience that I didn't get on my first read through, but when I read it again and I understood what he was doing there, I understood that not only what he was doing, but that not everyone would get it, and it was a little wink and a nod that only the keen readers would figure out. So that was kind of my motivation there.
Nice. That's actually a neat little thing. But yeah, there's many writers out in the world doing different things. I mean, are you familiar with Charles D. Lind?
No, I am not.
Another Canadian author. He lives out in Ottawa, but he's like one of the progenitors of doing what they call the urban fantasy.
Oh, so yeah.
All of his stories are set, or sorry, most of his stories, most of the ones I've read, are set in real locations, most of them in Canada. And then he introduces the elves, the fairies, the witches, all that stuff into the modern world and starts projecting it out. And he also uses a fair bit of poetical style as well.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so he's interesting. Like I said, I used to read a lot more, and there was a lot of fun stuff to read. He's got one book out there called Moonheart, I think was the first big one that broke for him. But yeah.
All right, nice.
Moving on. So, getting back to the evolution of book writing and distribution and stuff. Are you with a publisher or do you self-publish?
I self-publish.
Okay, and how do you self-publish? Are you doing it through the Amazon, the Ingram system? I mean, there's like several of them out there, different ways.
Yeah, I do it through the Amazon, which used to be CreateSpace, but now they've just folded it all into Kindle.
Yeah.
But you still get the paperbacks and the Kindle. They're pretty good dealing with them. They have very competitive prices. And the only problem with it is if there's every sort of issue, then you're stuck dealing with just a bureaucratic machine and have difficulty actually talking to a person. But
hence the reason why I called it the Amazon.
Yeah.
I used air quotes on that too, by the way, which you can't see because this is not video. So yeah, I mean, I've noticed the same thing. That has been one of the major shifts that I've noticed from publishing. I mean, in the old days, it used to be the big publishers. You had your big five publishers. And if you wanted to get popular, you had a very low chance of doing it because there was only 5% of their authors were actually getting the deals. And everybody else was like, yeah, you're just stringing along. And then we shift over to the indie publishers and the smaller presses and stuff. And now over the last, what, 5, 7, 8, 10 years, there's this huge shift onto the self-publishing thing.
Yeah, I remember my first book, actually, I did through Lulu, which is another self-publishing site.
Are they still around?
And, I think they are. They're all right, but they're not quite Kindle, Amazon.
No.
But I remember first learning about that. There was a story in a newspaper. This is probably close to 10 years ago. And it was a big new thing that they were talking about then. And now there's everywhere. You've got Ingram, you've got Lightning Sparks or whatever the other one is called. Yeah.
Yeah, there's so many I can't even remember their names anymore. And the Ingram one I always remember because they are also a computer distributor as well as electronics and a variety of other stuff, which I deal with on a regular basis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. The world is this huge place. Big stuff. So, I mean, in the old days, like 10 years ago, about when you were starting out, and this is why I remember it with a little bit more negativity, is the entire environment was like, self-publishing? Ew. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and there was a bit of that attitude when I first heard of Lulu, and I thought, I don't want to go that way because it seems like, you know, just a cheap, you know, not the professional or right way to do it.
Yeah, they used to call Lulu Vanity Press.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But
you could find thousands of books on there, and they sucked.
Or there's a lot of them that were on there that were just like reprints of like copyright-free stuff that someone had put a new cover on or their own name, and it's like that just seems shady.
Yeah. Everything from Project Gutenberg you could ever imagine, here you go.
Mm-hmm.
So but obviously that has changed.
Yes, it has. There's a lot more going on with the self-publishing now. In fact, most of the local authors I meet go through some form of self-publishing or another.
Yeah, and some of the established publishers or authors that I'm aware of now as well, they've started taking their back catalogs like, you know what? I'll publish it myself, whatever.
Yeah, if you can, why not?
Yeah, I mean, the whole goal of being able to write is to make some money on it as well as to enjoy it, right?
Yeah, and the thing about self-publishing is that, you know, once you have it up on the website, unless you take it down, it's always there. Anyone can go on at any time and they'll print a copy and send it to them, or they can do the digital. Whereas if you're traditionally published, then, you know, there's an initial print run of however many copies. And if it doesn't sell well enough or sell quickly enough, then they might not do another print run and you might never see that copy again.
Lulu is still in business.
Really?
And they're the first hit when you search for self-publish. Oh my God, I can't believe they're still around.
They must have paid off someone at Google for that.
Oh, I'm sure that they have paid through the nose for Google SEC scores or whatever so that it's up the top of there when you type that. But yeah, no, it's crazy.
All right, well, good for them, I guess.
Meh. 313 million hits on the word self-publish. Insane. All right. So, I mean, so being a self-published author, how do you go through on, do you do all of the bits, like the formatting, the selecting of the cover and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, so I do all the formatting myself. Usually I will do a proper format. So I write all my chapters as individual documents. That way, if there's ever anything that gets corrupted or anything like that, then I haven't lost the whole book, which actually I have lost chapters before because of corruption.
What?
Yeah, it's not fun. It's like it was a case of like I didn't hit save, and I was on a train and my computer just died without warning me about the low battery. And by the time I got home and started it back up, the whole thing was just like, you know, the wing ding boxes. And I tried to recover it, and it couldn't go. but yeah, so that's why I individualize my chapters, and then afterwards I'll combine them all together. I'll do a format, and then, you know, on the final edit, I'll double check the format. The cover, I have a cover artist that does my work for me. He's nice. Very good.
Nice.
Plug out to him. He's R. Philip Ashman in Whitby. He's amazing. But I will generally tell him like what I'm looking for on a cover. I'll give him some ideas and he'll come up with something great. And then I just have to add the title on in the font that I want, and you know, the blurb at the back about the author type of thing.
Do you change it up every time, or do you use the same blurb?
Sorry,
not blurb. I mean the about the author, and then the blurb obviously different about the book.
Yeah, the blurb for the book changes. The about the author thing, I will update. I'll keep like the same information. I'll just update it. So like I think on an earlier book, I said I came from Belleville, which is. Yeah, inside Belleville, it'll be called Bell Vegas. it's a little local nickname. And I think I said on one of the earlier books, despite the lack of casinos or Elvis impersonators or something like that. Well, since then, Belleville's actually gotten a casino, which they had to fight for like 10 years to get.
And an Elvis impersonator.
Well, I say that the real Elvis is alive and well in Tweed, which is just north of Belleville. That's Tweed's claim to fame, is that you know Elvis is still alive and in hiding up there. So
I don't even recall the name of the town of Tweed.
It's if you go up 37 from Belleville by about 20 minutes, half hour, it's a small little town on a lake. It's like a cottage country type town.
Stoko Lake?
Yes, that's the lake.
Oh my God, I have never been around that area.
There's not a whole lot up there.
Yeah, I can't imagine it is from that picture.
Yeah, it's like a small town of like 4,000 or so people. And if you've got a cottage, like a lot of my family have cottages up that way, so it's nice to go out and relax. But otherwise, there's you know, it's not a bustling metropolis.
There you go. I must have driven a past when I went to Ottawa. No, I wouldn't have, because I would have done the 401. All right. Understanding.
But yeah, it's the claim to fame there is that Elvis is still alive and hiding out in Tweed.
Yay, Elvis.
Hmm. But so yeah, I updated the about the author to say that it now has one casino in Belleville.
Ooh. Four slot machines?
I haven't been there, so I'm not sure.
I was making a small sardonic remark.
You know what? It could have passed for the real thing because you know, knowing Belleville, that would have been a great accomplishment for them.
Oh, so it's like a corner room in the local bingo hall.
Yeah, exactly. No, apparently it's a nice. It looks nice from the outside. I've driven by, but I tend to play table games. I don't like slots, and I haven't really had the time to go and stop in to see what's actually there.
Cool. I've never actually been into a casino.
Really?
Yep. Never been my thing. I play poker. I play the whole nine yards. But I've never actually gone into a casino because I've never really needed to.
I like the atmosphere, especially I've been to Vegas. I was in Vegas in 2013, and I just like walking around because it's everything is fake, but it's not like, well, you know, it's fake, like the Eiffel Tower and the Statue of Liberty and Caesar's Palace is clearly fake, but it's not cheaply fake like you'd find like a mini putt. It's well built. And it's almost like the real thing. And then you can go and, like, you know, make some money or lose some money at the same time.
Well, it better be well built because otherwise people will go into it and then it falls apart. And it's like, okay, now we got dead people. Which is fine by my writing styles.
Yeah, well, it was mostly built by mafia money. So, you know, who knows how well it was actually built back in the day.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting towns, cities, / whatever. It's like, why would anybody build a city here? Because nobody else would build a city here. That's why we chose it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, okay, let's get into some other commentary question marks. Now, do you ever use the opportunity as a writing to be a pedestal to do social commentary and talk about, oh, world sucks and we got to fix things, or other types of environmental type commentaries?
So there's always a theme of some sort to my writing,
mm-hmm.
some of which is, you know, social or political. My first novel was actually, I think I went a little too strong on that. because it was all about kind of gay rights in the United States, and this is back before the, you know, the nationwide same-sex marriage legalization. And now, thankfully, it's largely become like a dead issue.
Yep.
Apart from, you know, a few stupid corners of the internet. There are people still, but I don't see, politicians or mainstream figures that are still trying to ride this dead horse. Otherwise, I'm trying to now move on to make my writing a little bit more timeless and more just kind of attached to the human condition rather than, political issues of the day.
Cool. And in the same vein, like I know you're on Instagram. By the way, what's your Instagram handle?
At Harijans Hounds. H-A-R-U-J-I-N-S Hounds with the at sign in front.
At. Don't forget the at.
Yeah.
And what about Twitter or any other social media?
It should all be aligned under that same name.
So you just type in Harijans
Hounds.
Harijan.
Or you go to my main website, jasonmshannon.com. Don't forget the M. And then there's the social media bar at the bottom. That'll just connect you.
Excellent. See, we got to make sure that the guests come on and actually state where they can be found, because, that way people can stalk them.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, it's important. So do you get involved much with social media and engaging with consumers, fans, that sort of thing?
Yes and no. If fans tweet at me or tag me in something, or email me, my email's listed there as well, then I'll definitely respond. Hopefully it doesn't wind up in my junk mail. I don't spend a lot of time going out and just social engagement. I do have a YouTube channel, which I used to make videos for that would mostly promote my books, but it's just so much time and effort to try and edit the videos down and make it look halfway professional. Time I could instead rather be writing, which I'd rather work on.
I got good news for you. There's lots of tools out there now for video editing that make it a snap.
That's good to know. Unfortunately, my laptop is got the big red bar of saying, like, you have used 90-whatever% of your hard drive space, and I've already moved most of what I can onto an external hard drive. So until I get a new computer, I probably won't be downloading any new programs to video edit.
You know what you should do? You should get the new, and I really shouldn't say it, but there's a company that has a logo that looks like fruit that released their official computer desktop new one. Was it yesterday? Today. And if you were to max out this desktop computer, it would be $63,000.
Really?
But you're talking 128 terabytes of RAM? All sorts of other crazy specs?
Yeah, that's a little bit more than I think I would ever use.
But I want one. I just want it now, damn it. I can't afford it, but I want it.
Yeah.
So, all right. Now, I like technology. I've been a fan of technology for a long time. I think there's a lot of good and bad to it. I mean, look, Terminator's coming out, right?
Is it coming out still, or didn't it just come out?
Well, the Dark Fate movie came out and kind of disappeared. I think viewing audience decided, not as good as we thought you were going to make it. So we'll pass and move on to something else. Like, what was it? Frozen 2, that was it.
It didn't really get a lot of advertisement either. I remember it was kind of like here and then gone.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of issues about how they decided to go with the story on that, where it's like, but we've all done this already. All it is basically you got Arnold and Linda Hamilton doing some cool stuff, and then that's it. We're gone. Mm-hmm. Okay, so whatever. So, what about conventions? Do you do much in the way of conventions? By the way, I met you at Fan Expo this year in Toronto, so that's where we started off connecting.
Yes. That was my first year at Fan Expo this year. This year, I actually really tried to, tackle doing a lot more conventions than I normally do. There was maybe three or four that I would do readily every year. But this year, I think I did, I don't know, 7 or 8 of them. And nice. Next year, hopefully even more.
Cool.
Yeah, basically anything. I'm trying to branch out more. I went to CanCon in Ottawa this year, not to sell, but just to kind of check it out and see if it's worthwhile, which it looks very promising. So hopefully I'll be able to present there next year.
Excellent. And do you think do you feel that that's actually good opportunities for you to do two different sides, actual sell or network?
It's good opportunities for both, actually. Because you meet a lot of authors and editors and publishers, those indie publishers out there, and just organizers for other events. So there's your networking. And you do sell at these things. Even if you don't necessarily sell the paperbacks, I've always noticed an uptick in my ebook sales in the week or so afterwards. So it is worth it.
Cool. And of course, as part of that networking, you met me and you came to my Artist Alley project.
Yes. Which, that was one of the many good connections I made at Fan Expo.
See? It's all about making good connections.
Mm-hmm.
I used the thumbs ups as well. You can't see that one as well. That's fine. So, Kickstarter and stuff like that is a very big thing in today's multimedia environment for trying to package and sell a product. Have you ever tried considering any kind of Kickstarter projects?
I haven't, mostly because, well, I guess a couple of reasons. Number one, writing a book is not very expensive. You just kind of sit down and write, and then you have your minor fees at the end. But also, I haven't used Kickstarter, but I'm given to understand, like, once you post something on there, you have to kind of post a schedule and updates and let your backers know. And sometimes when I'm writing something, it either falls apart or I have to set it down for a few months and go on to write something else. And I don't really want to – I tend not to even announce stuff that I'm working on until it's pretty much a sure thing.
I understand that one. I've seen a number of Kickstarter projects where the entire work is done. It's just now it's the cost, and they use Kickstarter as a distribution medium.
Yeah, that I could look into that.
Yeah.
Not sure how that would work really for a novel, but I could look into it.
Yeah, I just throw it out there because Kickstarter is, again, it's another part of the platform that's changing as far as how we distribute and how we receive products. I mean, Amazon has changed the retail community tremendously, even just in the books alone. I've seen, I think last year, was it? Or this? Yeah, I think it was last year where 51% of all retail sales was occurring online as opposed to in physical stores. That's insane.
Yeah, no one wants to leave their house anymore. If they can get it delivered, why not? And also, like, the last time I was in Chapters, and I love Chapters to death, but you go in there now and it's got the very open concept and they've got a lot less books and it's like there's pillows and candles and picture frames and it's like, I come here for books. I don't come here for all this stuff. I could go to a Bed Bath & Beyond for this.
Yeah. And you mean Indigo Chapters?
Yes. Yes, it's Indigo now in Oshawa, which has got the big, white logo and everything. And
it's white logo? I thought it was purple.
Well, it's like a white interior. So you walk in and it's all like white walls and white shelves, and it's very different from how Chapters used to look.
Yes, and tall walls and bookshelves everywhere, and it's like, where does this go? I don't know. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a big one here as well that I go to once every couple of years. Yeah, so, I mean, random things. Do you like cookies?
I do.
What kind?
Chocolate chip are probably my favorite.
Okay, I won't say anything against that because I like chocolate chips.
All right.
What would be considered your favorite movie?
Favorite movie. Okay, here's a weird one for you, just because it's hard to pinpoint why I like it so much. But the Ocean's trilogy, specifically Ocean's 13, if I had to choose one. Probably just because it's so well put together and it's like a strategy movie. And I like the strategy aspect of it, where you're not entirely sure how it's going to play out until the end.
That is not the choice I would have pegged for you.
I know it's a weird one to list, but it's up there.
Okay. All right. Well, everybody who listens to my show knows that my ranges are eclectic, to be putting it politely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we already did the author thing, so that's not going to work. Favorite TV show?
Favorite TV show. I'm not sure if I have a single favorite. I did really like Game of Thrones,
mm-hmm.
Until kind of the last season, which I didn't dislike, but it didn't leave me wanting to go back and watch it all again. Boardwalk Empire is one I finished a few years ago, and I've been really wanting to get back into that one. Just rewatch that. What else? I liked Westworld the first season.
Loved Westworld.
Yeah, the second season was not quite as good, but it was still pretty good.
Exactly. Have you checked out The Expanse?
Yes, I've been following The Expanse. That's actually really good. I've read the books for that as well, and they follow it fairly closely.
I have heard. And one of the things I really liked about that show was I could envision all of this happening.
Yes, it's like that in the books too, where they've kind of got, you know, the political forces at work, and then, you know, these corporations that have a lot more power than they should. And they've kind of got like a universal basic income aspect in there as well. So there's a lot of stuff going on that you could see happening in the next, you know, 100 or so years.
And I just really like the fact that the science, I could see the steps that lead to that science. That science is real. It's believable. It's like, yes, these things could happen. Unlike the movie Battleship, which I absolutely loathe.
I don't know if I've seen that. Oh, Battleship, the based on the board game?
Yeah.
Yeah, I tend not to watch movies based on board games, so I didn't see that one.
It was pretty much the only movie I've ever seen that was based on a board game.
That's the only one I could probably name based on a board game. But
other than Clue.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one either.
But it's got Tim Curry in it. We like Tim Curry. Tim Curry is an awesome actor.
Yeah, he is.
He's got Wide Range. Wide Range. But yeah. All right. So throw up some final tags for yourself. How can people find you again?
The best way is through my website, jasonmshannon.com. I do have a second website, which is horrorsandtowns.com. That's specifically for that series, and the two of them connect to each other. So if you log on to either one, then they'll take you to the other one. And then, of course, all my my tags are down at the bottom. I believe it's at horrorsandtowns for pretty much everything. It should be facebook.com/horrorsandtowns. I'm on Twitter, Instagram. YouTube is probably just some long, youtube.com/something for 20 digits. But it's, again, the best way is through the website, jasonmshannon.com, and the social bars at the bottom. And I do have like an events page on my website as well. So if you want to come see me in real life, then that will be all there on the website.
Most excellent. I'm going to throw you one more question.
All right.
Favorite Christmas movie coming up, or that is out?
That is out.
Favorite Christmas movie.
Just of all time, I would have to say National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Okay, I can live with that. I have a list. Last week's episode was about Christmas movies. I, of course, did only Christmas horror movies.
Oh, okay.
If you get the opportunity, check out a short movie called Treevenge.
Treevenge? That sounds interesting.
It's about it's about trees that are being harvested for Christmas and then go nuts and decide to break free and take their revenge on humanity.
Okay, now here's a quick question for you if we have time.
Fire.
You have eclectic taste in movies.
Yes.
A friend of mine and I like to watch movies that are so bad they're good.
Yes.
And then make drinking games out of them.
Oh.
Do you have any titles you would recommend?
Oh, I got crap tons of titles. Start with Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving. Okay.
Yes.
Actually, I think I've seen a trailer for that one.
It's so bad. But it's great.
It's like a giant turkey or something running around?
Well, it's actually a rubber chicken turkey running around. He's not even a giant rubber chicken turkey. He's a normal-sized rubber chicken that they just sort of prop up and use as a, hey, he's the killer turkey.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible, but it's awesome. And the great thing about that movie is that the guys who did it really knew that they were doing that like that. It has a $4,000 budget.
That's the best way to do things. If you can do like something intentionally so bad it's good on a cheap budget, and then just it develops a cult following.
Absolutely. I love the movie. I have loved the sequels. Thanksgiving 3.
How many has it got?
Two movies.
Oh, yeah?
Thanksgiving 3 is about trying to find Thanksgiving 2, which never got released.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's a corny joke that they use throughout the whole movie. It's like, all right, that budget on that movie was $250,000. They expanded their reach.
Well, they did that with Birdemic as well. Birdemic was, I think it was like $20,000 or $30,000 the first one, but then it got picked up by a studio, and they just tried to milk the second one by hitting all the same beats, and it was like taken too seriously, but not seriously enough, if that makes sense.
Yes, I would tend to agree with that. I saw a trailer today for a movie that I didn't know was coming out. Zombie Tidal Wave.
That sounds interesting. I'm guessing some sort of actual wave of zombies coming at you.
Tsunami. And it's made by the people who did Sharknadoes.
Of course.
Ian Ziering is in it. And he's the producer. And probably the director of the damn thing. But yeah. Whatever. Like I said, there is... I have watched many, many movies. Some of the... Oh, yeah, here you go. Killer Sofa.
Killer Sofa, nice.
And Velocipastor.
Velocipastor.
So it's a pastor, a priest, who turns into a velociraptor.
That sounds interesting.
And the velociraptor outfit that he turns into is, you know, those blow-up raptor outfits that you can get for Halloween?
Those ones I see in memes all over social media?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's the velociraptor. It's like, what? It's like, oh my god. It's insanely bad, but it's hilarious.
Nice.
Yes. So on that note, Jason, thanks for coming out again and being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And everybody out there in Audio Land, all the streams on, I can never remember all the name of them, Streama, Stream Finder, TuneIn, or whatever. Thank you all for joining us. Have yourselves an after-rotten good time. Come back every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at this exact same channel. Follow us on the Twitters, follow us on the Facebooks, follow us on the Instagram. And by the way, I'm sure I'm going to open up a couple more social streams because what the hell, why not, right? And then I think I will play the extra song right there because, oops, I hit the wrong button.